Welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm Michael Hiltzik, sitting in for Ian Masters. My guest right now is Michael Eisen, a professor of biology at the University of California at Berkeley and an investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. His research encompasses evolution, development, genetics, genomics, chemical ecology, and behavior, and he's a strong proponent of open science and a co-founder of the Public Library of Science, which is a great publisher of scientific work. And we're here to talk about Proposition 37, which, as you may know, was the California ballot proposition on the last ballot that was designed as an antidote to genetically modified foods. Proposition 37 was defeated at the polls after a multi-million dollar campaign against it, financed by mostly food processors and the agricultural industry. It was billed as a consumer-friendly measure that gave people power over the food industry by forcing manufacturers to label their goods at the store if they were produced through genetic modification. Some supporters also had the idea, and one of them was Dr. Eisen's Berkeley colleague, Michael Pollan, that passage of Proposition 37 would launch a nationwide pure food movement. Michael, thanks for joining me and welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
Great. Well, you are the proprietor of a fascinating blog entitled It Is Not Junk, and that's at michaeleisen.org, michaeleisen.org. And I hope I'm not embarrassing you by saying that you've done more for scientists and laypersons over the years than many other people by establishing the Public Library of Science, which, as I said, is a publisher of scientific journals designed to make research more available, not less, and where I believe you're still on the board, if
correct.
I'm correct. Now, you wrote fairly extensively about Proposition 37 during the campaign, and one of your great posts on it was entitled Proposition 37 and the Right to Know Nothing. Your argument was that this was a measure that was not going to achieve what its supporters claimed it achieved. And why don't we start by you're giving us a bit on where you thought it went wrong.
So, I mean, I think the central problem with Prop 37 was that it presented itself and was trying to sell itself to the voters as a simply a measure to provide information to consumers. The signs that went up all over California, especially in Berkeley, were about people having the right to know. The ads were about consumers having the right to know, and yet the proposition itself and most of the rhetoric behind it showed no interest in actually informing consumers about the technology. It really was about giving consumers a quick and easy way to avoid a technology that they were afraid of for various reasons, most of which I think are invalid. And the pitch was basically you have a right to know, and then didn't take any steps to try to inform consumers about the technology, as if the right to know was simply a right to avoid. And to me, the reason I was so put off by this initiative was that there's a lot of misunderstanding about the technology of genetic modification. I think there's a lot of fear in the amongst the consumers, largely born out of a lack of understanding and a lack of knowledge about what's involved in the technology and how it works and why that a lot of people who understand it don't think that it's particularly dangerous. And the initiative, instead of trying to address the lack of understanding in the public about the underlying science, chose simply to make science and this particular scientific technology a kind of boogeyman for everything that people don't like about the food industry and so forth. And to me, I felt this was a sort of unconscionable attack on science. It was an attack on the importance of having a rational discussion about technology and its benefits and risks, and that this rather than promoting a better public understanding of science and technology, was doing exactly the opposite. It was encouraging people to be afraid of the technology. The proponents of Prop 37 were often reaching for completely discredited ideas and fears and research about the risks of the technology, and showed no interest in trying to educate the public about what it's actually doing.
Right, and it seems to me that one of the indicators of this is that it treated genetic modification as though it were really one technology, when in fact it's sort of a blanket description of a whole wide range of techniques used in developing seed stocks and hybridization and all sorts of things, some of which may have implications for the environment, some have not, and some of which are clearly aimed at reducing the risk of ingesting certain foods rather than having the effect of enhancing them.
Right. I mean, it's a complicated field. I mean, the technology has advanced dramatically in 20 years. There's a lot of different things that people are already doing, or, you know, ways in which the technology is already used in agriculture. And there's many, many more to come as genetic technology gets more advanced and more powerful. And you're exactly right. You know, the idea that the proper way to treat this technology is simply to slap a label on food, treat it all the same, and not take any steps to differentiate between not only the different types of underlying methods used to generate these technologies, the type of transformations that they wrought, and the ways in which they're used. This all was assumed to be irrelevant to consumers, and that the only thing they'd be interested in it was that this technology was used in creating a plant. Which, even if you give credence to some of the fears people have about the risks of particular pieces of genetic technology, which I don't, but even if you do, consumers should want to know what the particular modification is, how it was used, what kinds of things it encouraged the farmers to
right. They should know more and should try to know more. Again, I'm speaking with Michael Eisen, professor of biology at the University of California at Berkeley, an investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. And we're talking about Proposition 37. Michael, a moment ago you made a reference to some of the studies or some of the assertions about GMOs that were seized upon by the pro-Proposition 37 lobby and communicated to the public. You and I have talked in the past, and I wrote a column about a study that had been produced by a French researcher named Gilles Seralini that made quite a splash during the campaign. Listeners may recall some of the news reports about the study. It purported to show that rats that had been fed genetically modified corn had developed really grotesque tumors, and there were photographs that accompanied the article and that were widely published of some of these rats and really gross tumors, clearly designed to disgust the reading public and to enhance the sentiment against GMOs and thus in favor of Proposition 37. Now, when I saw the study and was preparing to write about it, I spent a lot of time talking to experts, reading other scientific studies, trying to take the measure of the discrediting of this study that had been fairly widespread in the scientific community. But I do this. I do this sort of investigation as part of my job. Most laypersons don't have the ability to do that, and that raises a question that maybe you can address, which is how should the average person, when confronted with what purports to be authoritative scientific evidence but is really discreditable, how should newspaper readers or TV viewers or just interested parties assess this sort of complicated data?
Right. I mean, I think there's a big issue, perhaps a bigger issue to discuss there, which is that the public, doesn't really have they're not engaged in the process of science in an active way. I mean, this is one of the things that led us to start the Public Library of Science, actually, which is far bigger than just the genetic modification issue, but that the there is a serious problem with the way that scientists try to communicate to the public. The study authors did not really engage did not attempt to engage the public in the research process that they were undertaking, why it was that they designed the study this way, how it was that the study could inform the public about the safety or lack thereof of genetic technology. Instead, you know, they engaged in a press campaign trying to scare the public about the risk. And I think the problem is the public isn't really in a good position to read a study like that and understand why it's where its flaws come from. And I think, you know, this is to me is one of the things that is going wrong more broadly in our public interactions around science that is exemplified by Prop 37, which is that people don't view scientists as honest brokers in any of these issues. That most of the people in the pro Prop 37 side assume that anybody involved in science who was commenting on the validity or wisdom of these studies was intrinsically tainted by their association with scientific research. And I wish I had a good and simple answer for how to address this. But I think one of the ways to do it is to make sure that legislative efforts that are formulated around bad science, fears of science, and a lack of understanding of the technology are not allowed to go forward. One of the things I think is good about the defeat of Prop 37 is that it forces people who are interested in promoting labeling on genetic technology to try to come at it from a more scientifically valid way that won't anger and upset the scientific community. And, you know, I think that that the Seralini study is an example of something that's gotten really bad in our public discourse around science. You know, people want to read scientific studies like, you know, Republicans in the later days of this campaign wanted to read polls. You know, they'd search around trying to find a poll that would come down on their side of the issue, and then they would trumpet its results. People in Prop 37 were doing the same thing with science. They, rather than trying to look at the accumulated body of information around genetic technology, look at, you know, 20 or 30 years worth of studies into its safety, think about the basic molecular biology that leads a lot of scientists like me to conclude that this is not a particularly risky technology. They don't care about that. They want to find one gotcha study and say, aha, this is a disaster. Look what it did to these poor little rats.
And this sort of technique really does lend itself to misrepresentation. And it seems to me that you're in a way making an argument against legislating on these sorts of issues where it's so complicated, legislating through the initiative process where inevitably the debate unfolds in 30-second television commercials rather than hearings and the presentation of real evidence. Now, we're going to have to wrap up in just a few minutes, so I want to take the last two or three minutes to ask you. You made the point, I think, during the campaign that if the promoters of Proposition 37 really were devoted to the idea of providing consumers with the most useful information, they would have written Prop 37 in a different way. Give me some ideas, if you can, as to what you think an effective bill might have had. And once again, we only have a couple of minutes left.
So I think I believe that the public would benefit from a better understanding about how food is produced, what kind of what kind of seeds and stock and so forth went into their production. And so what I think should happen, and what I think that would have been successful had it been proposed, is an effort to have more comprehensive food labeling in which consumers are provided with information, whether it's just on a label or on a QR code on food products or whatever, with as much information as is practical about the origins of the varieties that were used in the product, the farming practices that were used in producing them, and so forth. That would include, but not be restricted to, genetic modification. I think this would achieve the kind of, you know, consumer-powered interaction with the agriculture industry that people like Michael Pollan were promoting. And what's more, I think it would lead to a better and more general understanding of amongst consumers of the ways in which these technologies are being used today and why they're being used. That is a labeling initiative that was actually trying to provide consumers with information about the agricultural practices behind the products that they are buying and consuming would have been much, much, much more popular and much more successful and might have withstood the millions of dollars of advertising that came from the No on 37 side. And I really hope that the people who are backing this initiative will take that as their next step forward to make real food labeling rather than sort of anti-science scare tactics.
All right. Well, thanks very much. Thank you for joining us today. I've been speaking with Michael Eisen, professor of biology at the University of California, Berkeley, an investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and one of the founders of the Public Library of Science, which is basically a new model for communicating scientific information to other scientists and to the public. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Michael Hiltzik, business columnist for the Los Angeles Times, sitting in for Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments. We'll be back tomorrow at 5 p.m. with more interesting guest hosts throughout the week while Ian takes his well-deserved vacation. Bye for now. The other became